This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the significance and implications of Russia's disinformation campaign during the 2016 U.S. elections. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, earlier this month, indicted 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities for conducting an illegal information warfare campaign to disrupt the 2016 U.S. election, to help then-Republican candidate Donald Trump win the White House and demonize Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. The special counsel's team has uncovered a vast organizational operation that Russians started building in 2014 and accelerated with a budget of over $1.25 million monthly during the 2016 election. The Russians did not just go after Hillary Clinton in the general election. They also undertook efforts to denigrate other Republican candidates during the primary campaign, like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. The indictments say the Russians tried to influence the election by, for example, encouraging minority groups in the United States not to vote in the 2016 election or to vote for a third-party candidate, placing ads on social media and other sites advocating for Donald Trump and opposing Hillary Clinton, using Facebook group and Twitter accounts to organize two political rallies in New York, March for Trump and Down with Hillary, paying for an actress to portray Hillary Clinton in a prison uniform in a cage on a flatbed truck. President Trump's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, said the evidence was incontrovertible that Moscow was engaging in a campaign of disinformation, subversion, and espionage that he said Washington would continue to expose. Just days before the indictment, a phalanx of U.S. intelligence chiefs testified on Capitol Hill and asserted the underlying theme of the indictments, that not only did Russia interfere in the 2016 U.S. election, it is already meddling in the 2018 midterm elections by using a digital strategy to exacerbate the country's political and social divisions. Despite this overwhelming evidence, President Donald Trump continues to refuse to fully acknowledge the malevolent role Moscow has played and continues to play to undermine the U.S. democratic system. Well, joining us to discuss the significance and implications of these indictments and Russia's continued meddling to undermine American democracy are Mark Simakovsky. He's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. He previously served in senior positions in the U.S. Department of Defense, dealing with NATO, Europe, and Russia policy. And David Salvo, he's resident fellow with the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. The Alliance for Securing Democracy is a bipartisan project that tracks ongoing efforts to subvert democracy in the United States and Europe. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Well, Mark Simakovsky, let me begin with you to get your take on the significance of this development, these indictments, and why is this different? Because we've known, by virtue of our U.S. intelligence community, that Russia indeed meddled in the 2016 election.
Special Investigator Mueller's investigation, if written in several stages in a book, this is possibly one of the most important chapters, and one that both clarifies the scope of Russia's involvement in meddling and undermining U.S. elections, but also lays out clear evidence, and evidence that has to be held up in a court of law. Again, Special Investigator Mueller has a wide swath of investigations that he's conducting, both in the Russian activity as well as American citizens' activity in potentially colluding with a foreign power to undermine our elections. This clearly lays out in painstaking detail both the individuals involved, the scope of their activities, their travel, their financing, and it lays out key questions, and I think we can discuss clear links to the Russian government in this involvement. Also, this investigation comes as Mueller himself continues to face pressure from the Trump administration and has helped insulate him and create essentially a barrier against being fired. And he did this at a time when he needed some of that insulation. And lastly, it puts additional pressure on others like Mr. Manafort to give more evidence to showcase that essentially the U.S. president is linked to some of these accusations regarding Russia.
Paul Manafort, you're referring to.
That's correct.
Turning to you, David Salvo, to either add or subtract to what Mark just said, and perhaps you can shed light on some of these individuals or groups, the Internet Research Group and other people connected directly to the Kremlin who were engaged in these covert activities.
Well, we've long known that the Internet Research Agency, which is based in St. Petersburg and funded by the Russian government, has been undertaking information operations against the United States, and not just the United States, but democratic countries all over the world, particularly in Europe. And this agency essentially tries to exacerbate existing divisions in countries. So it's not as if the Russians created the social and political climate that we see in the present-day United States, but they have exploited and taken advantage of those conditions to widen existing political and social divides that undermine the social cohesion of democratic societies.
And we're seeing that as we speak, that Moscow continues to engage in these activities to discredit the FBI. They're stoking divisions around these horrific school shootings, reinforcing the most extreme positions vis-a-vis guns on both sides of the issue, immigration, and so forth. Isn't that correct?
It is, exactly. And what Mark said about the indictments is accurate, that the indictments show the extent of the state-run operation, how sophisticated it was. But it's important to keep in mind that these operations are ongoing. And like you mentioned, the school shootings, the Russians will use social media accounts, particularly on Twitter, to amplify far right and in sometimes far left positions to pit Americans against one another.
We'll talk more about the use of social media in a minute, but first back to you, Mark Semikovsky, to talk about the ultimate goal of Vladimir Putin's Russia in engaging in these activities, whether against the United States or other Western democracies. What is their ultimate goal?
You know, I think the ultimate aim of President Putin is to first and foremost fundamentally undermine both the U.S. democracy and Americans' confidence in U.S. institutions. And it's to almost create a cleaving effect where there are existing, as David has said very accurately, cleavages in our society and differences. And if Americans, through questionable results of the election, can further lack confidence in Washington and institutions of this country, then the Kremlin both wins in terms of Americans having a lack of confidence in their leadership. But more importantly, the United States, throughout its history, has been a beacon of hope and inspiration for countries around the world. And if the Kremlin can undermine the confidence of U.S. allies and partners around the world that there is a strong, steadfast, responsible American partner there, then that serves the Kremlin's interests also, to showcase again that the U.S. can't be trusted, that U.S. democracy is a sham, and that people around the world who are seeking themselves and their countries to ally with the United States are allying with a false prophet.
Back to you, David Salvo. To build upon what Mark said, isn't it also to create chaos in democracies with the ultimate goal of trying to assert themselves on the world stage, that is Putin's Russia, to have a seat at the table? We see them in the Middle East, whether in Syria and their coup actually in eastern Ukraine by having illegally annexed the Crimea. They're doing this, all of these activities, to enhance their particular system, which is totalitarianism, autocracy, lack of freedom, lack of liberal order.
Well, I think as Mark said, by undermining U.S. leadership around the world and undermining confidence within our allies and partners, governments and societies in our ability to project leadership, the Russians automatically have an advantage in places like Syria and Ukraine because we are distracted and there's a lack of confidence in our ability to play a positive role in those conflicts. However, there's a domestic component to what Vladimir Putin is doing as well, and that is by destabilizing democratic societies, he can point the finger at us in the West to his own population and say, look, this is why we have to have an authoritarian system, a managed democracy, as they call it in Russia. This is why we need an authoritarian system of government, because look how corrupt and weak and unstable democratic nations are.
Indeed, to keep themselves in power, since they can't do it legitimately.
Precisely.
They have to do it by destroying or trying to destroy others. Back to you, Mark Semikovsky, for the Russian reaction and to these indictments. Of course, it goes without saying that they're denying everything. And I don't think we'll see any of these entities or individuals anytime soon in a U.S. courtroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first, one more thing to add is in the perspective of the Kremlin's viewpoint in 2016, they believe that by backing President Trump, that they would have an amenable counterpart that would fundamentally transform U.S.-Russian relations. If not having a Manchurian candidate in the White House, they at least believed that there would be a quid pro quo for the assistance that they provided to the Trump campaign, and that would be a lifting of U.S. sanctions and a reset of U.S.-Russian relations. Now, of course, we can discuss what ended up happening, but again, there was a belief that they had someone of a like mind, and that's also why they believed they needed to undermine the democratic system in the United States. But the Kremlin's reaction is, I think, expected. They've denied, obfuscated any role, and just like they've denied military involvement in Ukraine, and they have denied massive involvement in places around the world in elections in France and Germany. Those denials for me are almost an affirmation of their involvement, because many times those denials end up with people getting medals in the Kremlin. And just as it happened in Ukraine, the Russians ultimately, I think, are somewhat happy with their involvement, but you're not going to see any of these people named extradited to the United States.
If they're not extradited to the United States, David Szabo, these individuals and entities that are in the indictment, are they restricted in their movement from now on? You know, are they penalized in any way?
Well, sure. I mean, those who were indicted who traveled to the United States on American visas, for example, lied about the purpose of their travel. So there is now in our State Department systems information that would prohibit them from coming back to the United States on a visa because they lied about their travel. There can also be sanctions that are imposed on these individuals. The administration, of course, has the ability to impose sanctions. Congress can. It's up to the administration ultimately to implement congressional sanctions, which they've so far failed to do on a number of other occasions. But those levers of power exist.
I want to get into sanctions in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Mark Simakovsky. He's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and David Szabo, from whom you just heard. He's resident fellow with the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. We're discussing Russia's interference in the U.S. 2016 presidential election in light of indictments brought against 13 people and three companies by U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener and Facebook fan Barnabas Anyam, who currently resides in Abuja, Nigeria. Thanks for writing. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to the issue of sanctions, Mark Simakovsky. It's very interesting that the Congress did pass additional sanctions at the end of 2017 to punish Russia for its interference in our presidential and legislative elections. And yet, to date, I don't believe the White House has actually implemented them. How do you explain that?
You know, I think the White House so far has done a mixed job in implementing those sanctions. I think they've drawn up some elements of some of the reporting, like an oligarchs report and a defense and intelligence industry report. But they have chosen to take a broad perspective and have chosen not to escalate sanctions against Russia. I think part of that is a result, again, of President Trump's own personal views of seeking to avoid actions that hamper U.S.-Russian relations. I don't really believe that they've been able to deter some of the activities that allow them to avoid sanctions. But again, the U.S. government itself is a bit divided. I think many of Trump's own officials and cabinet members would like to see a tougher stance to Russia. The U.S. national military strategy that recently came out escalated and elevated the threat from Russia in a U.S. government document, which is something much stronger than the Obama administration was willing to put in its own national security strategy. But again, it's those divisions within the U.S. government and President Trump's own interests in maintaining positive relations, I think, that has limited sanctions towards Russia.
David Szabo, why, in your view, have the sanctions that the Congress passed last year not been imposed yet by the administration or imposed as aggressively as they could have been?
Well, I think Mark is right. There are divisions within the administration, and the president ultimately, who would ultimately make the decision about imposing sanctions, is worried, I think, about the potential links between his campaign and people close to him and the Russian government. And I think a lot of this is motivated by fear. He keeps saying that he's adamant in his denials about any sort of relationship with the Russians, but I believe that there probably exists some information that ultimately the special counsel will uncover that points to some financial relationship between whether it's the Trump family business and Russia or something along those lines. And I think he's concerned about that.
Well, President Trump keeps saying that there's no collusion. He tweets no collusion in big letters. So if there is indeed no collusion or any kind of conspiracy, then why does he consistently deny that the Russians interfered in our election? Now we have incontrovertible evidence, Mark Simakovsky.
Yeah, I think the president, you know, firmly believes in his views. I think he'd be much smarter to tweet less and talk about Russia less and allow the facts to come out based on the Mueller investigation. And I think what people need to realize is the special investigator has to come up with evidence and facts that can be backed up in a court of law. That's why I think this is so monumental, is that, again, there's a lot of wrinkles about what did Russia do. Mueller's investigation and this indictment is an iron onto a shirt that flattens out the evidence and showcases in ways that can be clearly laid out and have been researched for months about what the Russians did. And ultimately, these facts will go to trial, just like the Manafort trial will come up. And again, I believe that President Trump is trying to wish away what happened in 2016 and believes that there's domestic political support for him to make claims where a lot of Americans believe that either nothing happened or that there's a partisan bent to the accusations against his campaign. And I think as more evidence has come to light from the U.S. intelligence community, as well as from Mr. Mueller's investigation, as well as from the Russians themselves, will showcase that, in fact, the Russians did meddle and try to undermine our democracy and likely are working now to undermine the midterm elections in 2018.
Well, then, speaking of the midterm elections, David, we're seeing senior policy makers coming to Capitol Hill again, testifying, saying that they don't think that the United States is still doing enough to safeguard our electoral process. How do you explain that? And one quick follow-up, and that is that, again, even if there are measures being taken at a lower level, how effective can they be without the leadership of the White House, which seems to be lacking at this point, given Mr. Trump's consistent denials that Russia interfered in the election?
Well, the best thing that the Trump administration could do, and President Trump himself could do, to ensure that members of his own political party are willing to take steps on ensuring the sanctity of our elections, is to come out and call foreign interference of any sort in our democratic institutions a national security threat. Right now, I think it's hard for there to be bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill to pass legislation that would fix a lot of these vulnerabilities because of this hyper-politicized environment where we simply can't divorce the conversation about electoral interference from the 2016 election. There's an investigation ongoing, and it's important that that continues. However, there are going to be continued efforts to undermine these elections in November, the 2020 elections, and we have outdated electoral infrastructure. We have a disparate electoral infrastructure system where states and localities have different systems. And we know that the Russians probed 21 of our 50 states' electoral infrastructure, breached the voter registration databases of seven states. So there are easy legislative solutions to some of these problems, and yet we can't get them passed in Congress. So I think that shows you just how politicized this issue has become, and it shouldn't be.
Turning back to you, Mark Simakovsky, because I want to talk about the role of social media companies and platforms in Russia's interference in the election. Mueller's indictments, and even before that, we saw how vulnerable these platforms are and the fact that they were exploited. So have you seen any evidence that Facebook or Twitter have instituted safeguards that could thwart a sophisticated and well-funded foreign influence operation?
No, I think just as some in the U.S. government have expressed dismay at being surprised by the Russians, I think many of our social media companies were also surprised, and I think they're slowly coming to grips with that. They also have their own institutional biases of not wanting the U.S. government to pressure them to control and provide information. But, you know, the Mueller investigation was conducted with cooperation with some of these companies. And so, yes, I think there is a realization, both because of the election, but also because of incredible congressional pressure that's likely going to continue to bear down on them to be more transparent, that they're going to be more interested in cooperation. Again, and this goes back to where we started, is why did Mueller indict these individuals when he did? He is serving as a public service announcement to showcase to the United States public, as well as to our institutions and our private sector, that we need to do more. And without laying out evidence of what happened in 2016, people aren't going to realize and wake up that the Russians are continuing. So he's trying to serve as a deterrent and a wake-up call for U.S. officials to understand that this went on and to get to the bottom of what's going on right now to ensure, again, as David said, we have to be prepared for the 2018 elections. And without the president calling a spade, it's going to be difficult to do so.
Back to you, David Szabo. You certainly have your finger on the pulse of the social media companies and their, I guess one could almost say, collaboration or even complicity, even if unwitting, in allowing the Russians fake identities for Facebook and Twitter, engage and use their platforms. Now, we know that the Mueller investigation and indictments shine a light on the Kremlin's covert activity, but is there a similar effort to shed the light on the complicity of these social media platforms, especially the algorithms that help the Russians spread their false messages across the country?
I think there has slowly been a reckoning within the tech companies that their commitment to openness and connectivity has been exploited in ways that they did not anticipate or ever envision. And in a way, I'm almost sympathetic to them in that respect. However, I think they've also been reluctant to be transparent without congressional pressure so that the American public can understand how their business models work, how their platforms can be used and misused. And it will be important for them to take some initiative on their own, or they're going to face, I think, pressure from Congress and others. And we've even seen private companies try to exert pressure, like Unilever, for example, pulling their ads from Facebook and Google because these companies have refused to take the threat of foreign interference as seriously as many Americans would like.
Let me go back to Mark Simakovsky. Mark, what do you think needs to be done at all the various levels to deter and punish Vladimir Putin and his covert operation going forward?
So first, I think accurately the United States needs to view Russia as a threat and needs to come together in an interagency fashion to come up with a strategy to deter and defend against future Russian domestic attacks, as well as deal with Russian malfeasance around the world. I don't think we should be necessarily focusing on ways to improve our relationship with Russia. I think we should be defending our national interests, but also seeing Russia as a nefarious actor that needs to be dealt with. We need to strengthen our institutions here at home. We need to help states prepare themselves to avoid a repeat of the 2018 election. 2016 election. And also we need to allow this investigation to not only continue, but give Mr. Mueller the resources to ultimately get to the bottom of this investigation. And the president needs to state publicly that Russia is a threat and that the U.S. government should have all the tools at its disposal to deal with that threat.
And the last word to you, David Szabo.
Well, I agree with a lot of what Mark said. I would add that we need to raise the cost of this type of aggression on countries like Russia. And maybe the next time it won't be Russia, it'll be a different country. But the fact is this government and this Congress need to take a firm stand and show the Russian government that it will not tolerate this sort of activity. And that means imposing sanctions on the people closest to Vladimir Putin. You need to punish this regime where it hurts. And it's a corrupt oligarchic regime. And ultimately, if you squeeze the pockets of the people close to this president, you're going to undermine that regime. That's the way to raise the costs against a country like Russia from conducting these operations. Here at home, again, like Mark said, we need to ensure that states have all the resources they need to protect their electoral infrastructure. Americans need to know who is funding ads that they, political ads that they see on platforms like Facebook. There's an easy fix to that. on TV and on radio and other media, the source of funding for ads needs to be disclosed. Why can't we do that online as well?
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Simakowski, he's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and David Salvo, resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.